Nice to see everyone again. Welcome to Great Decisions, Part 16. And tonight we're discussing the Six-Day War, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rabbi Leib. You have two momentous decisions in Israel's definitive wars towards the end of its first quarter century of existence. The decision to launch a preemptive strike, meaning to attack first, on the eve of the Six-Day War in 1967, and the decision not to launch a preemptive strike 6 1/3 years later on Yom Kippur 1973. Both decisions define the wars themselves and shape both the outcomes and the perceptions, and the perceptions were as important as the outcomes. It had been 11 years since Israel's last, most recent full-scale war, the Sinai Campaign in 1956, we discussed last year. That war was a smashing success. The diplomacy that followed, an abject failure, which of course is not an uncommon pattern. All territorial gains that Israel made were reversed within 6 months. Israel left the Sinai and left Gaza as well, in exchange for an Egyptian agreement to allow Israeli shipping through the Straits of Tiran and through there to the Gulf, to the Indian Ocean, Orient, etc. That military victory stunned the Arab world and the West, which now perceived Israel as a major player and basically ceased all efforts to impose a political settlement on Israel. Israel didn't seem real to the world for the first 10 years. After they won in 1956, it was real. It became a power. It also brought into Sinai the UN peacekeeping forces for the first time, the United Nations Emergency Force, UNEF, that would keep the two sides apart and monitor the ceasefire until it wouldn't. It was based in Sinai because Israel refused to allow it on Israeli soil. That would become a pretext for the Egyptians to remove it as well. The end of that war in 1956, that presaged more than a decade of relative quiet in which Israel was able to further develop its military and focus on nation being. Gone for the time being were the existential threats that had dogged Israel in its first decade. They would return, and they'd seemingly never leave, still exist today. So the question is, what happened in 1967 to bring the Arab world and the Jewish state into open and armed conflict that would enable Israel to more than triple the size of its territory and change the map of the Middle East? So what were the causes? Well, Israel's relationship with all its neighbors was always tense, and for the most part consisted of low-intensity conflict during that period from 56 to 67. There were border incursions and terror from Jordan, followed by reprisals from Israel. There was artillery and air exchanges from Syria, including fierce disputes and confrontations over water rights. Oddly enough, the border with Egypt was mostly quiet, especially because of the UNEF war stationed between the parties. But the hostility of the Egyptians, the leader of the Arab world, was unrelenting. Gamal Abdel Nasser spoke at a pan-Arab conference in March 1964 and said, "The danger of Israel lies in the very existence of Israel as it is in the present and what she represents." So his hatred was relentless. This was said at the same time that the Arabs created the PLO, which came into existence 3 years before the Six-Day War, before the so-called occupation of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, and 6 years before any settlement, you know, the obstacles to peace, were built. PLO terror began in 1965, almost immediately after it was founded. Fatah launched either from Jordan, from Gaza, sometimes from Syria, supported financially and logistically by the Egyptians, by the Jordanians, by the Syrians. There were two threats facing Israel in those years, the mid-1960s. The primary military threat came from the Syrians. After Israel constructed the national water carrier to transport water from the Jordan River from the Kinneret to the rest of the country, the Syrians began to harass the Israelis constantly. intensely. At one point in 1963, when the Arab League decided to divert water from the Hasbani and the Banyas rivers, the tributaries, two of the streams whose waters flow into the Jordan River, then to the Kinneret. So those two, the Hasbani and the Banyas, were under Syrian control. The third, the Dan, was controlled by Israel. So the Syrians tried to divert the whole project, divert the water away from the Jordan, which would have starved, obviously, the Jordan and the Kinneret of water and made the national water carrier somewhat superfluous. The Israelis attacked, and they stopped the diversion. Then began the years of steady artillery bombardment from the Syrian-occupied Golan Heights down to the kibbutzim below, down to the Emek Achula. In 1965, 1966, children there regularly slept in bomb shelters. Farmers and shepherds were regularly killed and injured from the shelling. What especially galled the Syrians was Israeli farming in what was the demilitarized zone. Attacks on farmers there led to Israeli reprisals that engendered the shelling of the kibbutzim. So it was an endless cycle. And remember as well, it's hard to imagine today, but remember that Israel controlled a sliver of land on the eastern side of the Kinneret, Engev and its environs, but a sliver encompassed mere meters, with the Syrians perched above and firing down below. Lest you think the UN turned against Israel only after 1967 or 1973, Israel regularly protested these bombardments from Syria, which were never condemned. Only condemnations received were for Israeli retaliation. If that hypocrisy is the pattern today, and it still is, as witnessed by that translator last week at the UN, you might have heard, it still is the pattern. It has a very, very distinguished pedigree. That was the military threat. But the military threat was exacerbated by the ongoing threats and intimidation in which Nasser specialized. The rhetoric of war was a constant, a drumbeat. And you know, it doesn't take much to rile up the Arabs, and the populations were regularly inflamed. 1965, we shall not enter Palestine with its soil covered in sand. We shall enter it with its soil saturated in blood. A few months later, Nasser stated that the goal of the Arab world, and this was the new pretext they fabricated in 1965, I quote, the full restoration of the rights of the Palestinian people. In other words, we aim at the destruction of the state of Israel. The immediate aim, perfection of Arab military might. The national aim, the eradication of Israel, end quote. One can make a cogent argument that the aims have never changed, not even 50 years later, and the tactics have changed only slightly. It wasn't only Nasser. The Soviet ambassador to the United Nations, Yaakov Malik, a prototypical self-hating Jew, lambasted Israel's retaliation strikes and said that Israel's aggressive policies endangers Israel's very existence as a state. Now think about it, that we've also heard in the last few years. It's not the aggression that's problematic, it's the retaliation, as if Israel has no right of self-defense, and any self-defense is perceived as aggression. What endangered Israel's existence even more than its reprisal strikes was the massive weaponry that the Soviets poured into Egypt and Syria in the mid-1960s. So the rhetoric was harsh, but the reality was that the Arabs were only biding their time and waiting for the right moment to attack. And yet, as 1967 dawned, there was no reason to think that full-scale war would break out in 1967. Terror and sabotage continued. The shelling from the Golan continued, but also a pattern that we're familiar with. Israelis had adapted. This was life, and life was punctuated every now and then by grieving over victims and the losses. The three Arab states that surrounded Israel now use terror as their proxy, exactly like is done today with Hezbollah. Rather than engaging their armies, they use terrorists, whether PLO or native grown. But there was a major escalation on April 7th, 1967. almost 2 months before the war. Israel retaliated against Syrian shelling that had killed some farmers, and in a battle of tanks, artillery, and planes, Israel bombed villages on the Golan and beyond, and came very close to Damascus as well. In all, the Israeli Air Force shot down that day 6 Soviet-supplied MiGs. Six MiGs that the Soviets had given the Syrians. MiGs, by the way, is an abbreviation for Mikoyan and Gourevitch, who were the designers. Mikoyan was an Armenian, but Gourevitch was a Russian Jew who died in the 1970s. The Soviet defeat in the air was so complete that day that Israeli planes flew a victory lap around Damascus, to the horror and humiliation of the Syrian government and the citizens who watched from below. Syrians claimed to have shot down 6 Israeli planes also. Unfortunately, no wreckage was found. And people knew it was a lie because they saw the Israeli planes overhead. Within weeks, the Soviets, embarrassed by the destruction of their aircraft and very sensitive to maintaining the appearance of Soviet military might. Remember, the Vietnam War was then raging in another conflict of Soviet weapons versus the West. The Soviets began feeding the Syrians false information that Israel was conducting a military buildup as a prelude to war. In fact, this talk had begun already in May 1966, and the truth is the Soviets were largely responsible for ratcheting up the pressure and fomenting the war. A strong case can be made that but for the Soviet role, their demonstrably false lies about an Israeli buildup and plans for war, there would have been no war. You can make a very strong argument. Israel time and again offered to take the Soviet ambassador to Israel to both fronts to see that there's no buildup going on. He refused. The theory is that the Soviets saw Israel as vulnerable. The Arabs were powerful, certainly outnumbered, outarmed Israel. And with the U.S. bogged down in Vietnam, the time was ripe for the elimination of the American presence in the Middle East, that is to say Israel, leaving the region under total Soviet hegemony. With that, after that battle in April 1967, the Syrians invoked a defense treaty they had with the Egyptians, and they turned to Nasser for assistance. Now, let's step back for a moment. There are many wars. World War I's at the top of the list that can be seen as accidental wars, meaning they're unnecessary. They didn't have to happen, but for wrong moves, misinterpretations of actions or statements, the bluster of some of the parties, and raw miscalculations. In many respects, the Six-Day War was such a war. Even the totality of the victory was almost accidental, as we'll see. So who were the major players involved in the march to war? Israel's prime minister then was its third prime minister, Levi Eshkol, originally Shkolnik. He was born in Aratov in Russia into a religious family, went to yeshiva in Russia, then went completely off the derech. He made Aliyah when he was 19 in 1914 to Dagan Yabet, became a Labor Party official. But he was always perceived as somewhat lackluster, a simple farmer, which is how he liked to describe himself also, really what he enjoyed as well. He became prime minister when Ben-Gurion resigned in a huff in 1963 in the wake of another revelation from the Lavon affair. And Eshkol literally did not know what to do when he came to the office the first day. He had been minister of agriculture and minister of finance, both of which were jobs. He sat down before his desk on the very first day in office and said, what am I supposed to do now? Because he had nothing to do, and it took him a few days to figure it out. Eshkol was widely criticized for his conduct here and his tenure in office, but in recent years there's been revisionist thinking improving his reputation. The truth is that in his 6 years in office, he accomplished some very important things, and not only the military success. One I mentioned already, it was his proudest achievement, the creation of the national water carrier, HaMovil HaArtzi, that carried water from the Kinneret to the central and southern regions of the country. Think about it. Until then, they relied on aquifers or above-ground water tanks. There's a whole system to carry water to the rest of the country. He said that water is the basis for Jewish existence in the land of Israel. Had he added, "V'ein mayim el Torah," it would have been a different state, but he didn't. He also established diplomatic relations with West Germany, which was important and controversial. He allowed the reburial of Zev Jabotinsky in Israel on Har Herzl that Ben-Gurion had vowed never to permit, and he didn't as long as he was in power. Jabotinsky died, as you know, in New York in 1940 and was buried out in New Montefiore Cemetery, where I unfortunately get to visit a few times a year, where now just a plaque covers his old grave. And here as well, Eshkol, his pre-war conduct would be debated for decades. His hesitations, his inconclusiveness, his indecisiveness, but his reputation has improved over time. For some, Eshkol is best known as the most quotable of Israel's prime ministers, with some very famous lines. He had a very good sense of humor. Apparently, he was the originator of the joke to Olim, how do you make a small fortune in Israel? Come with a large fortune. Apparently, that was his joke. Famously, he once promised someone a job and then reneged. And when the job seeker said to him, but you promised, Eshkol responded with a line that only a politician could love, yes, I promise, but I never promise to keep my promise. In a takeoff on a well-known joke, he said, you put three Zionists in a room and they'll form four political parties. He was also the last of Israel's prime ministers, and really the last they'll ever have, who thought in Yiddish, and for whom Yiddish remained his primary language. Of course, he spoke in Hebrew and he spoke a passable English, but he often lapsed into Yiddish at cabinet meetings, and when he wanted to express himself clearly and forcefully and emotionally. Gamal Abdel Nasser had been the leader of a military coup in 1952 that overthrown Egypt's King Farouk, and he himself seized power in 1956. So Nasser was bombastic. Aspired to the leadership of the Arab world, a hater of Israel, who nonetheless, like most of the Arab leaders, held secret talks through emissaries with Israel throughout the early 1960s. He was a manipulator who knew how to play the Americans against the Soviets, and for a long time he received aid from both countries by making conflicting promises to both. Nasser was also paranoid, irrational. By 1967, he was suffering from worsening diabetes that would take his life in 1970 at the age of 52. He could stir up a crowd with his rhetoric, the so-called Arab street, and fill them with a passionate hatred of Jews and Israel, and occasionally other Arab countries as well. For years, he promised that Israel's end was near, and he was one of the pioneers in fabricating the so-called Palestinian cause in the mid-1960s as a bludgeon to use against Israel. So he, not entirely, but he had to abandon the rhetoric because extermination of Jews was unpopular. Couldn't use the word extermination, but fighting for the rights of the oppressed, homeless, and persecuted refugees was a much more efficient way of achieving the same goal. Don't we know that? One aide later summarized Nasser to a T. He said he knows how to start things, but he doesn't know how to finish. Nasser boxed himself into going to war and talked himself into believing that Israel's end was at hand and he would be the toast of the Arab world. Instead, he was toast. King Hussein was even better than Nasser at the double game, a master. He was duplicitous to the core, with one overriding goal in his mind, to hang on to his throne. So Hussein was with his grandfather, King Abdullah I, in 1951, when Abdullah was shot to death in Yerushalayim, in Al-Aqsa. But he was too young to take the throne. He was only 15. His father became the caretaker, but his father, Talal, was mentally ill, a schizophrenic who could not function. So he just literally sat in the throne for 2 years, maybe never left. And so Hussein became the king in 1953 at the ripe age of 17. Plus, his family were interlopers, not native to Jordan, and his grandfather had been given the territory of Transjordan by Winston Churchill in 1922 when Churchill carved up mandatory Palestine and left just 20% of the land for the Jews west of the Jordan River. His grandfather was the pioneer of the double game, at various times supporting partition and the Jewish state, at other times going to war against the Jews, and his grandson would do exactly the same. For years, Hussein conducted secret talks with Israel, especially about his water needs, but even fed Israel information about Nasser's plans in 1967, and yet he refused to sign a peace treaty for fear of the Arabs, he said. Several times in the 60s, Nasser tried to have him killed, and the enmity that existed between Egypt and Syria and Jordan makes one wonder how they ever thought they could fight a war together. Hafez al-Assad, by the way, was the commander of the Syrian Air Force during this time. I'll give you another example of the double game. The retaliations for terrorist acts were mainly against Syria and Jordan, in the latter case emanating from Yudan Shomron. But Hussein often apologized privately for the terror, vowed to combat it. In fact, he would arrest terrorists to show his good faith and then release them within days after the point was made and before the Arabs could protest that he'd imprison them. Exactly what Arafat then did in the 90s and the early 2000s. But Hussein's greatest success was manipulating the United States. For years, he was bankrolled by the U.S. For decades, he was on the payroll of the CIA. And in the eyes of the West, Hussein could do no wrong because he was that most prized and rare commodity, the so-called pro-Western moderate Arab. There always has to be one, a pro-Western moderate Arab, whether or not it's true. Today, it's Hassan Abdul II, to a lesser extent, Mahmoud Abbas. And there's a constant apprehension. If we don't give them support, money, and allow them their occasional violent excesses, they'll turn away from us. And then we will not have that pro-Western moderate Arab that we need. That's why just 3 years ago, as Hillary Clinton was touting Bashar Assad as a reformer, perhaps another pro-Western moderate Arab. Central casting always needs at least one. Some American presence as well, an important one, and that was Lyndon Baines Johnson. So, this week's the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. LBJ always lived in JFK's shadow, always resented it, always tried to overcome it. He was the first president to actually host an Israeli prime minister at the White House. That was Levi Eshkol, with whom he had much in common. He even took Eshkol to his ranch, a huge ranch in Austin, Texas. You'd often write at length about it in the prime minister's two precious stories. He was riding in a jeep in Johnson's ranch, and Johnson was babbling about some cows that he had over the roar of the engine, and Eshkol could not understand a word that Johnson was saying, and he turned to Yaakov Herzog, puzzled, and he said, "Was red der guy? What is the guy saying?" Later that night at dinner, Eshkol ate the pheasant that had just been killed by the hunters that day. And when two of the diplomats, who was Herzog and Avner, asked for salads, they kept kosher, Lady Bird Johnson was embarrassed, and she said that she thought they could not eat meat, but that people who kept kosher could eat any type of bird. When she was informed otherwise, she asked, if that's the case, why is Eshkol eating the non-kosher bird? And Herzog, who was very quick on his feet, said that, "Ma'am, you have found Eshkol's vice. He loves fine gourmet cooking." Okay. Johnson, as is the wont of American presidents, told Israel right after the assassination that Israel has lost a great friend, JFK, but in him they have found an even greater friend. Every president likes to say that. But the great friend steadfastly refused to sell Israel any weapons on the eve of war and threatened Israel with a lack of support and even sanctions if they opened fire first. Soviets were governed by committee. Alexei Kosygin then was the most powerful. Brezhnev not far behind. Their policy was straight: to bleed the West, to support their Arab allies, and support they did. In the period before the war, the Ruskies poured $2 billion worth of arms into Egypt alone, 1,700 tanks, 500 fighter planes, more than Israel had, forget the other countries, and 1,400 advisors. So actively involved in the conduct of the war. Nonetheless, the Soviets still maintained diplomatic relations with Israel, That would not last long. Israel is now operating with mainly French weapons, but the French, especially de Gaulle, would turn on Israel with a Jew-hating vengeance that has not really abated. Hey, it abated 2 weeks ago. Okay, we live to see it. There we come really with what's the heart of the discussion, and that's what's called in the history of Israel, Hahamtana, the waiting period before the war. In May, the countdown to war began. Remember, the war didn't start till June 5th, 1967. But already in May, the atmosphere is extremely tense. After the April skirmish with Syria, the Arabs began taunting and goading each other. Goading Syria for not responding to Israel, Egypt for not coming to Syria's defense, each other, meaning Jordan, Egypt, and Syria, blaming each other for cowardice towards the Jews. So it was clear that Israel did not want war, it just wanted an end to terror. The escalation during the Hamtana can be measured in the rhetoric. Syria threatened Israel the day after the April battle, there will be a war, quote, followed by more severe battles until Palestine is liberated and the Zionist presence ended. Syria began moving heavy weapons into the Golan Heights, even as Egypt began to mass its divisions in the Sinai. In early May, Israel called up several brigades of reserves, naturally interpreted by the Soviets as proof of Israel planning for war. But Eshkol was doing the exact opposite. He hesitated before calling up the reserves. Too long for in the army's opinion. And then he left the reserves dangling for weeks. Moreover, Yom HaAtzmaut came that year, 1967, and the military parade, the annual parade, was curtailed by the government so as not to inflame the situation. Think about it, we barely have memories of it. Rehov Yafo, the traditional parade route, but just meters away from the border, the foot of Rehov Yafo was the border with Jordan. So it was felt in the government that a display of heavy weapons, used to march, you know, tanks and the artillery down the street, the display of heavy weapons was banned, so as not to be accused of moving artillery close to the Jordanian border. Ben-Gurion, from retirement, he hated Eshkol anyway, lambasted Eshkol for the surrender to international pressure and ruining Yom HaAtzmaut. Not only that, but he blamed him for impairing the army as well. There were demonstrations almost daily in Cairo and other Arab cities. Remember the demonstrations last year in Cairo? You wonder why people don't work. Who has time to go demonstrate every day? No, they do. They do even today, and certainly then as well. The masses calling for Israel's destruction. By mid-May, the Egyptian army was in place in Sinai, 100,000 soldiers poised to attack, still nothing. May 16th, Cairo radio. The existence of Israel has continued too long. We welcome the Israeli aggression. We welcome the battle we have long awaited. The peak hour has come. The battle has come in which we shall destroy Israel. And that was a comedy show on the radio. The only casus belli was Egyptian. Twice in these weeks they flew planes high over Dimona, where Israel already had its nuclear reactors, set off panic in the Israeli government. The jets were gone before the IF could respond. The Syrians also stepped up their shelling of Israeli settlements in the north. Then on May 19th, Nasser abruptly expelled the United Nations Emergency Force from Sinai, removing the last buffer between Israel and the Egyptians. Yabba Ibn, the foreign minister, always good with a turn of phrase, asked, what is the use of a fire brigade which vanishes from the scene as soon as the first smoke and flames appear? Meaning all those years the UNEF was there, they didn't do anything. Now they're needed, and Utant in a moment decided to remove them. On May 22nd, Nasser then announced that the Straits of Tiran off the southeast coast of Sinai would be closed to Israeli shipping. That not only violated the terms of the armistice agreement from 1956, the terms under which Israel had hastily and completely withdrawn from Sinai, but it was an act of war under international law. Blockade is an act of war. Israel turned to the international community to assert its rights, and they were rebuffed. And more, when de Gaulle was reminded of his 1957 commitments, he retorted, "That was 1957. This is 1967. That itself was galling, forgive the pun, and embarrassing because it was Ebon who had negotiated the 1957 guarantees that had now evaporated. And de Gaulle added to Ebon, who had gone on a tour of Western capitals, "Do not make war, do not shoot first." And he vowed whoever shoots first would never see French weapons again. And that's how the French embargo of Israel began. The U.S. was similarly unhelpful, if more diplomatic. LBJ had said he had no record of any such guarantees, couldn't find that paper in the archives. A request was made for an American security guarantee that Israel's attacked, the U.S. would intervene. That was denied. Both Dean Rusk, who was the Secretary of State, and Eugene Rostow is the undersecretary. Rostow was a key supporter of Israel. We'll count him later in the year, too. They both stated that Israel should not attack first. And Johnson himself threatened Israel. Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go it alone. The most the U.S. offered was to put together an international convoy that would sail through Meitzarei Tehran with an Israeli vessel, which it would protect. No date was offered for the convoy. In essence, Israel received sympathy for its plight, but little support and nothing concrete. Ministers went abroad to Shinar. Workers were urged, so to speak, to buy bonds, the equivalent of 1 month's salary, to finance the war that would come, or else. Meanwhile, Israel cabled Abba Ibon in Washington the latest intelligence that Egypt was now poised to attack. It was now the fourth week of May. Cairo radio continued to drumbeat for war. Quote, "As of today," Nasser announced the day after he expelled the UN force, "there no longer exists an international emergency force to protect Israel. The sole method we shall apply against Israel is a total war, which will result in extermination of Zionist existence." Kosygin threatened Soviet military action against Israel if they attacked. In exchange, the Americans promised to restrain Israel. While Ebon was in Washington, another intelligence report shattered the government's confidence that Egypt had brought poison gas equipment to the Sinai border. Eshkol read this and reverted to Yiddish, "Blut lizich gissen vi Wasser," blood will flow in the streets like water. And he said to Herzog, "Iftaf reden mit der galenter Nar," I want to speak to the learned fool, which was his nickname for Abba Ibn. The learned fool, because Ibn always impressed foreigners more than he did Israelis. Eshkol said another time about the Abba Ibn, "Ibn never has the right solution, only the right speech." So he wanted the galenter Nar, so he got Ibn on the phone and told him to go back to Johnson. "Zug dem Goy as mir haben zu tun mit Chayes, ihr hört mit Chayes. Go tell the guy that we're dealing here with animals. You hear animals." Of course, it's less than 25 years after the Holocaust. The image is a very powerful one. And still Israel did nothing. The Egyptian attack that we now know was poised to begin in late May was called off at the last minute under Soviet pressure. But the situation remained a tinderbox. More IDF reserves were called, and Israel, most of whose 264,000 soldiers were reservists, 75%, could not long sustain that type of disruption to civilian life. By the end of May, the country had shut down and panic was rising. People started preparing for war, stockpiling food and other necessaries. The Chevrat Kadisha in Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim dug thousands of graves in public parks, anticipating the worst. During this period, Eshkol decided to address the nation, calm their nerves, and reassure them that everything was under control. It backfired. He read his speech in a halting voice. He had a cold and a cough. He stammered over some of the words and sentences. He couldn't read his handwriting in other parts. He sounded unsure of himself. and panic grew. Menachem Begin, who was soon to be brought into the cabinet for the first time after 19 years in the political wilderness, said to his wife after hearing the speech on the radio, "He sounds like he's having a heart attack." Begin went to Eshkol and urged him to resign and have, of all people, Begin said, let Ben-Gurion take over the reins of government, because he's experienced as a war leader. Ben-Gurion, meanwhile, was blasting Eshkol for his bumbling leadership, and then a few people, including Begin himself, Begin went to see Ben-Gurion with others. And then Begin realized that Ben-Gurion, out of government now, almost 5 years, was out of touch. Ben-Gurion demanded that Israel not strike first. He was afraid of losing all international support, and he did not seem to realize how powerful the IDF really was. The army began clamoring for action, at least some of its leaders, to relieve the blockade on the grounds that acquiescence would erode Israel's deterrence and lead to other hostile actions. But even the army leadership was of two minds. They already had in place a plan from July 1966 called Mifsa Sadan, Operation Anvil, to fight a war on all fronts, and some were eager to attack. The most eager was the chief of operations, former head of the Air Force, Azer Weitzman. He was the most insistent, pressuring Eshkol. Interesting that you see the literature of the day, and that's how they called each other. He would call Eshkol, "Eshkol, what are you doing?" And he'd say, "Weitzman, what do you want from me?" They used their last names, berating Eshkol for weakness. Now, Weitzman was the second in command to the chief of staff, Yitzhak Rabin, who supported Eshkol and wanted to exhaust all diplomatic initiatives. Rabin wasn't as confident as was Weitzman or Ariel Sharon and others. Bear in mind, Weitzman said after the war he knew they would win. As soon as they went to war, he knew. Towards the end of May, Rabin disappeared for a day under doctor's orders. He later wrote that he was suffering from nicotine poisoning from days of cigarettes and sleeplessness. At the time, many thought he had a nervous breakdown, or at the very least had collapsed from exhaustion. What did happen was that Weitzman took over the operations management and essentially was the one in control until Dayan took over at the top of the hierarchy. After the war, you could read this in Weitzman's autobiography, after the war, the blustery Weitzman would say to Rabin, "You walk around like you're Yehuda HaMaccabee. You're the biggest bluff in Israel." All right, not everyone gets along. The people had no idea what was happening. In fact, there was a popular song of the time, I just heard the other day, again, I looked it up, "Nasser Michake Le Rabin." Nasser's waiting for Rabin. Little did they know how divided the government was. They just did not know what to do. The two leaders of the Mafdal, Dov's both, Rav Chaim Shapiro, Rav Zerach Verhaftig, pleaded that Israel not begin the war. They each expressed more confidence in LBJ's promises than the IDF's abilities. And the cabinet was really split. But on June 1st, the leadership changed. A national unity government was formed for the first time, including not only Menachem Begin as Minister of Portfolio, but more importantly, bringing in Moshe Dayan as Defense Minister, stripping that office from Levi Eshkol. The Prime Minister had always held both offices. Dayan was the hero of 1956, was already a national legend, and a member of the opposition Rafi Party that had started in 1965 by Ben-Gurion to try to wrest power from Eshkol. With Dayan now at the helm, there was a resurgence of confidence by the people. Several of the points after the mention, all weighing in on the decision. At this time, there was something else that was stirring in people. They felt that the country was awaiting great things, on the cusp of great things. On Yom HaTzmut that year, it was about 3 weeks before the war, like a prophecy out of nowhere, on the parade grounds center in Givat Ram, Naomi Shemer released her new song, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. People think it came out after the war. He came out before the war. And it ended with, it was a very poignant song. City sits alone. It ended with these lyrics. How have the cisterns gone dry? The square, the marketplace are empty. Nobody visits the Har Bayit in the old city. In the caves by the rocks, the winds wail. Nobody goes down to Yam HaMelech by way of Yericho. If the words sound unfamiliar, it's because 3 weeks later they were amended. On Yom HaTzmut as well, in the midst of the celebrations at Merkaz Arav, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook burst into tears. And he started to tell them how he felt when the partition plan was voted on. And he said he just cried, he couldn't dance, he couldn't rejoice. And now he feels the same way now, quotes the Pasuk in Yoel, that Artzi Chileku, they've divided our land. And our cook said, Eifo Chavron Shalanu, Vanachu Shachachim Ota. Where is our Chevron? Where is our Shechem? Where is our Yericho? Where is our Eder HaYarden? Haim v'yadeinu levater chas v'shalom afil o millimeter meretz Hashem? Can we renounce, God forbid, even 1 millimeter of God's land? It was 3 weeks before the war. That too would prove prophetic. And the yeshiva then, they discuss the import of Rav Kook's statement in Orot and Perek Yud, that when there's war in the world, mitorer koach haMashiach, the power of Mashiach is aroused, because God alone is the Baal Milchamot, Zoreat Zdakot, Matzmiach Yeshuot. And meanwhile, Jews across the world feared another Holocaust, and others saw it as a messianic moment. Israel benefited from something else as well. Eli Cohen, the spy, had given invaluable information about Syrian encampments on the Golan before he was captured and killed in 1965. But less known is that Israel had another spy as well, an Egyptian named Rifat al-Gamal, who was given a new identity as Jacques Biton, an Egyptian Jew who spied on Israel. He entered Israel in the 1950s, and similar to the Eli Cohen story, he became a businessman, and he made his way up the ranks until he was found out pretty quickly in the late 1950s. And the Israelis turned him, like an episode of Homeland. He became a double agent. His most successful feat, he convinced the Egyptian military that Israel was planning a ground invasion, not an initial airstrike. And Egypt bought this so convincingly that they ignored warnings that they received in real time by rogue CIA officials that Israel was planning an airstrike. They ignored the CIA because they had their own agent who turned out to be a double agent. The distrust that the Israelis had in American intelligence would lead Israel to attack the Liberty spy ship on the third day of the war. There's another spy also, Wolfgang Lutz, a German-born Israeli spy in Egypt, also Zohar Latov. In the week prior to the war, Hussein flew to Egypt to consult with Nasser, and the plans for war took root. Dayan's appointment calmed a lot of nerves in the country and the cabinet. Rabin started clamoring for action. You can't keep soldiers on edge for so long. The international convoy scheme was abandoned with no other option forthcoming. On Sunday, July 4th, the cabinet met. Some still wanted to send a ship through the Straits of Tiran and attack on that basis, meaning if the Egyptians fired on the ship, that would be a cause for war. But the army and Dayan objected, and they said that in fact would ruin the element of surprise, because the whole plan would be thwarted if they did that. It will put the Egyptians on notice. The cabinet authorized an assault on the Egyptian forces, and they anticipated an initial success and assumed that the world would insist on a ceasefire within 72 hours. Dayan said they're not going to attack Gaza at all. They'll get to the Suez, and that would be it. To Rabin, the IDF was now a mighty spring waiting to be unleashed, uncoiled. Dayan spoke of the heavy burden he felt. Ben-Gurion remained opposed to any military action. In any event, it was to be a limited strike. At 7:10 a.m., Monday, June 5th, Israeli planes took off from their bases. Within 90 minutes, the war was effectively won. Almost 90% of the Egyptian Air Force, was destroyed on the ground, enabling Israel then to strafe and harass the Egyptian infantry in Sinai, which rapidly began fleeing. At the same time, the Syrian Air Force was demolished as well. Pleas were made to Hussein not to enter the war. He did anyway, to his great chagrin. Syria entered the war when Egypt boasted of the colossal victory it was winning on the battlefield. Lies come back to haunt the Russia. Israeli forces first entered Sinai and achieved remarkable successes. There were battles. It wasn't simple. There were battles, but they prevailed at every point. Rafael Eitan became famous later as a chief of staff and cabinet minister. Rafael Eitan said, I quote, apparently someone in heaven was watching over us. Every unintended action they took and every unintended action we took always turned out to our advantage. Within 2 days, Israel had reached the Suez. On Tuesday, Israel began responding to Jordanian fire, which had been sporadic at first, and then on Tuesday picked up. Overnight, really it was early in the morning on Wednesday, Begin and Yigal Alon pleaded with Eshkol to capture the old city. Eshkol was against it, Dayan was against it. In the end, they gave in to just the force of emotion. The opportunity was there, and they never have such a chance to establish Israeli sovereignty unless they took it now. Many remained opposed, including the religious parties were opposed to attacking the old city, so as not to force Hussein into full battle. By Tuesday, as the Jordanians fought fiercely in and around Yerushalayim, the old city was already surrounded and the pressure grew. Overnight, Colonel Uzi Narkis was authorized to capture the old city. Wednesday morning, the 20th of Iyar, they entered Rav Kook's yard site. They entered through the Lion's Gate, through the Temple Mount, liberated the Kotel. That same day, Hebron surrendered without a shot. By Thursday, all of Yesha was in Israeli hands. On Friday, the battle for the Golan, notice how the war unfolded sequentially. On Friday, the battle for the Golan, initially also opposed by Dayan, began. He wanted a limited war. When the ceasefire was actually imposed, 6 days after the outbreak of hostilities, the Golan Heights, including Konetra, was under Israeli control. Approximately 800 Israelis were killed. The Arab casualty rate was 25 times that of Israel. The Arab armies were devastated. Within a week, Israel's map changed, more than tripling its territory. The Arabs were aghast and humiliated. You know, the War of Independence was the Nakba. This was the Naksa, the setback. And they vowed more war. Nasser resigned, and then was swept back into office the next day by popular demand. I was sort of doing that myself. Resign, make the people want me back. Only in Egypt. There are other enormous consequences that shaped Jewish life until today. Israel's borders were never... Don't give me any ideas. Israel's borders were never larger. And the vulnerability felt since 1948 was gone. There was a powerful feeling of unity among the people and across the Jewish world. The liberation and reunification of Yerushalayim, made final by its formal annexation just weeks after the war, an annexation immediately rejected then and now by the U.S., captivated an entire generation. Look, most Jews alive today, 46 years later, have no memory of an Israel without the Kotel, without Hebron. Within a few years, Yesha would be populated with Jews. A week after the war, 200,000 Jews came to the Kotel to celebrate Shavuos. Maybe one out of every 11 one out of every 12 Jews in the country. The plaza area, it's open today. You remember the old pictures? In a week, it was cleared of hundreds of Arab homes. No one said a word. And the Arabs across Yesha were thankful they weren't expelled en masse. Still, about 200,000 Arabs fled to Jordan, some from refugee camps in the west of the Jordan to the east bank of the Jordan. Elsewhere in the Arab world, Jews were killed, several dozen, and hundreds were arrested in pogroms that took place. And it really was the last stand for Jews in the Arab world, except for Moroccan Jewry. The interest in Aliyah would be sparked after the Six-Day War. And Soviet Jews, informed by propaganda during the war that Israel was being devastated, they came to life. And the drive for freedom for Soviet Jews began in earnest, as well as the awakening of Jewish identity in millions. This notwithstanding the revocation of diplomatic relations between Israel and the USSR and the Soviet bloc after the war. Everyone loves a winner. Israel's alliance shifted from France to the U.S., and LBJ began selling advanced weapons to Israel, including Phantom jets. The life of Israel as U.S. counterforce to the Soviets began as well, and that particular parsha would last well over 30 years. The world called for an immediate withdrawal, but the UN failed to pass such a resolution and left the matter open to negotiations and an anticipated withdrawal based on Resolution 242, which, by the way, made no reference to Palestinian people as they did not yet exist in a national context soon to be created. For many, the demon of the Holocaust was slain. Jews could defend themselves and against tremendous odds, and then some. Moshe Dayan, I was but a child at the time, but even I remember this, Moshe Dayan went to Vietnam to advise American generals there. Israelis, Jews felt a sense of pride, but also an invincibility that would not bode well for the future. Rather than cement their gains, the cabinet offered immediately to withdraw from the Sinai and from the Golan, also a mistake, and bad for Israel. All later wars will be judged by the success here, engendering the feeling that if you can't win in 6 days, there's something wrong with the army and the leadership. That's an unhealthy impatience with the norms of warfare. But in later years, even Eshkol has won praise for his caution, such that he did not succeed or receive in his lifetime. In essence, he waited until it would seem as if there is no other option, and then he fired the first shot. If Israel claimed that he could fire first, doesn't matter. Then he launched a preemptive strike. For many people, if the Egyptians had attacked, all plan would have been undone. But nonetheless, let the historians debate that. Eshkol would die in office less than 2 years later. And as I noted before, the lyrics changed of Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Chazarnu al barot amayim, lashuk v'lakikar. We've returned to the cisterns, to the market and the square. Shofar kore b'har abayit b'ir atika. Now a shofar sounds on the Temple Mount in the Old City. Uvama arot asher basela, alfei shmashot zorchot, 1,000 suns shine. Nashuv nered el yam hamelach b'derech Yericho. We will again go down to the Dead Sea by way of Yericho. Until Yemos HaMashiach, this might be the high point in the existence of the State of Israel, Baruch Hashem. Next week, we'll engage in a slightly lighter topic. We'll look at the great decision that really had ramifications that Jewish people feel until today, and that is the conservative movement's decision to allow driving on Shabbat in the early 1950s. What was that based on? Why did they do it? And how has that unfolded for their particular movement and for our world? That's next Monday night. Hope to see you then. Thank you very much.